the Gaza Strip that had been imposed continuously since 2007 was unlawful, collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza, and a possible crime against humanity. The conclusions were in the sense of the commission of the crime of persecution, a very grave crime against humanity, exactly because there was this disproportionate collective punishment on an entire population, 2 million people of Gaza, with the declared purpose by the Israeli authorities to try to break their support to Hamas and therefore diminish their possibility, apparently, to commit anything that could be harmful for Israel. And already at that time, the fact-finding mission concluded that the series of acts that deprived the Palestinians in Gaza of their basic needs of subsistence, employment, housing, water, as well as, of course, their freedom of movement, amounted to collective punishment and possible crime against humanity. So what we have seen after that is a very long and protracted now denial of justice, because while we are talking, it is 14 years later, we are still in a phase where we don't see any concrete steps in The Hague at the ICC. The investigation is now formally open since 2021, but we have not seen any warrant of arrest nor any concrete action.
And Chantal, could you talk more about this issue of Israel's claim that they will take actions to make sure that Hamas does not pose a threat to Israel in any form? I just want to read a statement, because, of course, what we hear again and again in light of Hamas's attack on October 7th is that Israel has the right to self-defense. And I just want to read a statement that UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, recently made. She says that Israel cannot, quote, claim the right of self-defense against a threat that emanates from the territory that it occupies, from a territory that is kept under belligerent occupation. So if you could explain that and what the distinction is between two things, the fact that it is a territory that is occupied by Israel, and second, that Hamas is, of course, not a state. It is a non-state actor that is considered by Israel, the U.S., the U.K. To be a terrorist organization. So what law applies in that case?
Yes, exactly. It is very important to understand what is the law, the legal framework that applies to this. Because Gaza is still part of the occupied Palestinian territory, and Israel, regardless of the disengagement, so the occupation changed its form in the Gaza Strip since 2006, but it didn't change substance, meaning that Israel is still exercising effective control on the Gaza Strip and its entire population by different means, not anymore with boots on the ground, but rather through controlling its borders, its aerial space, its sea, and of course also the civilian life. We have to remember that even the civilian registries in Gaza are still basically kept by the Israeli authorities. And as you know, of course, no one gets in and out of Gaza, not even the UN functionaries, not even international experts comes into Gaza if Israel do not allow this from happening. So this is why not the Palestinians, but also international bodies, the ICRC, the UN, have considered, and also the International Criminal Court, that Gaza is still occupied territory. This means that Israel bears very specific duties and responsibilities with regard to the civilian population of Gaza. Not only they should not harm them, they should actually protect them. So what we are witnessing in these weeks, but honestly what we have witnessed in particular since 2007 on, it's a violation, a grave violation of international humanitarian law, also taking into account the very strong duty that is placed on Israel as occupying power. With regard to the specific question you were making, you were asking me about whether Israel can rely or not on self-defense with regard to Gaza and with regard to Hamas, not being Hamas a state, but an armed group that is considered to be a terrorist group internationally. So I don't think, honestly, that this is the most important legal point to be disentangled. It is a very complex legal point, but it is only, if you want, it is only relevant if we want to discuss whether Israel's reaction to the grave crimes committed by Hamas on the 7th of October is an act of aggression or not. The point is that regardless of what we think in this regard, and I personally think that what Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur, is arguing is absolutely reasonable and can be the line to be followed. But regardless of whether we agree with her and with other legal scholars on this point, the issue is that the response, what Israel is doing after the 7th of October in Gaza is in grave violations of international humanitarian law, meaning the law, the rules that regulate war, the armed conflict. And so this is, for me, the most important point to make, regardless of the legitimacy or not of the intervention. We are witnessing very grave crimes that can be analyzed under the lenses of war crimes, of crimes against humanity, or, as we heard from Katie Gallagher and the CCR, genocide.
Reed Brody, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. You wrote this piece for The Nation called Gaza, Where is the Law? If you could lay out the argument you make in that piece and the background that you give about the role in particular of the International Criminal Court in the past in prosecuting or not prosecuting crimes that Israel was accused of.
Sure. I mean, as Chantal was saying, every attempt by Palestinians, by Raji and others, to use the International Criminal Court and other institutions of international justice to hold Israeli officials legally accountable has been sidelined or delegitimized as lawfare. I mean, as Chantal has said, the ICC really subjected the Palestinian complaints to this obstacle course over 15 years, to the point that in all of that time, there has been no charges have ever been brought. And this includes the things that, I mean, we're talking the decades of Israeli occupation, the collective punishment, the apartheid, the war crimes that work, but the illegal settlements. Settlements are illegal under international law to bring your people into an occupied territory. And they have been given the go slow treatment. First, it was the question of whether they were a state. The first prosecutor kicked the ball, spent 3 years looking at it and kicked the ball down the road. Fatou Ben Souda, the second prosecutor, spent 5 years conducting a preliminary examination before assuring that there were grounds to believe that both Israel and Palestinians had committed crimes, including the settlements, including war crimes. And then she left it to the current prosecutor, Karim Khan. When the Russian invasion, compare this to the Russian, so 15 years of no action. You compare this to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Right after the Russian invasion, it was the war crimes started to mount. The International Criminal Court and most of the Western justice systems did what they were supposed to do. Immediately, Karim Khan went to Ukraine, talked about it as a crime scene, raised an enormous amount of money for the ICC's investigation, and has already, in fact, issued an arrest warrant against Vladimir Putin. For the transfer of Ukrainian children. Compare that then to Palestine, where none of this has happened. Now, we did see, and I think this is important, last week the prosecutor Karim Khan, who has been, you know, criticized for not doing anything, for not moving, went finally to the Rafah crossing. He followed it up with a very powerful speech from Cairo, in which he spoke, you know, he spoke about the crimes that were, or he spoke about the allegations on both sides. He spoke very bluntly in a way to the Israeli authorities. He reminded them that the conduct of the conflict has to respect the laws of war, distinction between civilian population and military objects, proportionality, precaution. I think, as we can talk about, I think these are not being honored. But it was very clear to Israel that mosques, that churches, that houses, that hospitals have a protected status, and that it is that the burden is on the, as he put it, those who fire the gun or the rocket or the missile, to show that they've lost their protective status. Will this be followed up by real action for the first time? I mean, as many people have pointed out, the fact that there was no accountability for the last decades of occupation and crimes related to the occupation has created a sense of impunity. Are we going to finally deal with that sense of impunity?
On Wednesday, Israel's deputy UN ambassador Jonathan Miller claimed Israel always adheres to international law. This is what he said.
Hamas is solely responsible for the humanitarian situation in Gaza, and they have weaponized it to prevent Israel from defending itself. Israel does not need a resolution to remind us to adhere to international law. Israel always adheres to international law.
So that's Israel's deputy UN ambassador, Jonathan Miller. Reid, if you could respond to that and also talk about investigation of Hamas for war crimes.
Sure. I mean, you know, the core principles, as everyone should know, regarding the laws of war is the protection of civilians. Military operations can't be directed at civilians. And that's expressed through in the principle of distinction. You have to make a distinction between civilian objects and military objects. Even—and this is, you know, like in the hospital case, even where you say that there is a military objective there, the leaders still have to act with proportionality. They cannot just go and, attack civilians in a way that is disproportionate. And there's one can argue about what disproportionate means under the law. It's where that an action is expected to cause incidental loss of civilian life, injury to civilians, that is excessive in relation to the military advantage that's anticipated. It's very hard to see, as we look at this conflict today, the 10,000 people who have been killed, 4,600 children, how these things are considered proportion. I think Israel has a heavy burden to bear here to show in any way that these actions fit within the laws of the war. You brought up Hamas's crimes, and I think we all believe and that Hamas on October 7th committed very serious war crimes, probably crimes against humanity. These do not—just as the decades of crimes under Israeli occupation do not justify Hamas committing crimes against civilians, committing war crimes. Those crimes by Hamas cannot in any way justify further war crimes and many of the actions that are being undertaken by the Israeli armed forces today.
And finally, Reid, you are the son of a Holocaust survivor, a Hungarian forced laborer. Can you talk about what this means to you? You're in France. You live in Barcelona, Spain. The issue of increased anti-Semitism, and then also the equation of the criticizing of the Israeli state with anti-Semitism.
Well, those are a lot of questions to unpack. It's very difficult. I mean, I was in with Chantal, actually, in Germany last week, where it's very, very difficult to criticize the conduct of Israel, where the line is very thin. And as somebody who spent half my life in Europe, I'm also aware of how prevalent anti-Semitism is and how much and how careful we have to be not to allow criticisms of Israel to spill over anti-Semitism and to be and to be ruthless when we hear anti-Semitism. I come to my positions as an international lawyer, as a Jew, as the son of a Holocaust survivor. I don't think that these things can be conducted in my name, certainly. Obviously, in America and around the world, there are many Jews who have stood up and talked about not in our name. In Europe, it's quite, I have to say, in Spain, where I live, there are a lot fewer, and it's quite a big deal. But next week there's a rally in Paris by Jews who are against what Israel is doing. I think more and more this is becoming this is a question of humanity. One Holocaust does not justify another. This is what happened to my father's generation, to my father, to members of my family. Was a genocide, but just like war crimes don't justify other war crimes, there's an asymmetrism between what happened with the Jews and what is happening today. And I don't think we can invoke the Holocaust. We can invoke what happened to our parents to allow Israel to commit war crimes today.
And Chantal, finally, we just have 1 minute, but if you could say whether the fact that Hamas has taken over 200 hostages, 240 Israeli hostages into Gaza, what effect that has, what impact, whether there's any allowance or what international law says can be done in the event of a hostage taking on this scale in terms of the return of the hostages?
I mean, if I understand correctly your question, of course, also what Hamas did with regard to the hostage taking from Israeli civilians can amount to war crimes, is a violation of the rules of international humanitarian law, and it follows potentially under the jurisdiction of the... Now, what we really... And I think we will see an acceleration in the investigations. The international criminal are so dramatic. So, and I'm sure that the prosecutor will analyze 360 degrees responsibilities, meaning both the Israeli authorities and the Palestinian armed groups. But what we really urgently need is accountability and to break this circle of impunity, which fosters violence and has been already for too long denounce in this way as one of the triggers of the violence and brutality that we are witnessing today.
Chantal Maloney, we want to thank you so much for being with us, international criminal lawyer, consulted with the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and represents victims in Palestine before the International Criminal Court, and Reid Brody, human rights attorney and war crimes prosecutor, son of a Hungarian Holocaust survivor. When we come back, we'll be joined by the niece of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, She's calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Back in 20 seconds.
لكل أطفال الحجارة الذين ذاقوا المرارة لا تهابوا النار ولا تخشوا الجدار بل ثوروا كاتشي جفارا وكونوا أنتم الشرار أبطال بجدارة وكونوا أنتم الشرارة.
Che Guevara by Palestinian singer Amal Mercus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We spend the rest of the hour with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's niece, a Providence College political science professor and Middle East expert. She's the niece of Netanyahu's wife, Sarah Netanyahu. This month, she was one of the signatories to a letter from Jewish and Israeli residents of Rhode Island that asks the state's federal delegation to support ceasefire in Gaza. In March, Ruth Ben-Artzi spoke out about distancing herself from all contact with the prime minister's family. When asked by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz why she chose to speak out, she said, quote, "The answer is that I'm ashamed, sad, and angry. Ashamed that my relatives have no shame, that they're in a position of power that promotes and encourages violence, racism, nationalism, and fascism. These are not the Jewish values I absorbed and to which I feel connected. Israel could remain a country in which Jews find a safe and free haven of equality and partnership with all the population groups within the state's borders." Well, Professor Ruth Ben-Artzi joins us now, again, a Providence College political science professor and Middle East expert. She's an Israeli and U.S. citizen. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for being with us. Your voice has so much power because you are the prime minister's niece. Can you speak directly to him, to the people of Palestine and Israel and the world about what you want to see happen right now, Ruth Ben-Artzi?
So I, first of all, speak as an Israeli citizen, as an American citizen, as a person who is observing everything that is happening with my experience having grown up in Israel, and also as a political scientist who studies and researches these issues for many, many years now. From all of those different perspectives, I come to this realization we came to this decision that a ceasefire is really the only way that any solution can ever be achieved. I think that the continued violence that begets violence is only going to bring us further away from a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It's really important to remember that we've been hearing also from policymakers, from American policymakers, and even from Israeli policymakers, military experts, that there's no military solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And if there's no military solution to the conflict, there's no military way to eradicate Hamas as well. The more harm that we're inflicting, the more violence that is occurring, whatever anybody wants to as a backdrop to either justify it or to explain it, does not make sense for the future. It only brings us further away from finding that solution, from being able to move towards that political solution. And it's clear that the day that this war is over is going to be the day that a political solution is going to have to start to be implemented. The occupation, the siege in the West Bank, the siege in Gaza that happened until October 7th, all of these we typically call status quo, or we traditionally call status quo, but it's not really status quo because things are changing. The population is changing, the demographics are changing, the infrastructure is changing over all of these years of occupation. That can't continue. The management of the conflict that has been the policy of the Israeli government, at least since 2009, was never going to work, and it has no long-term prospects. The ceasefire is the only. We're seeing the numbers of innocent civilians who are caught in the crossfires, the number of those who are victims of this war grow every single minute. And that is, in addition to the humanitarian, to the all the humanitarian concerns that and the experts that you had on the show before me, the legal concerns. In addition to that, that also brings us further away from being able to implement the kinds of policies that we need to implement the day after the war.
And Professor Ben-Akhti, you've also, like many, of course, expressed concern about the well-being of the hostages who are in Gaza still, about 240 of them. If you could talk about how you think a ceasefire might make it possible for their safe return. I mean, it was just reported that Israel and Hamas appear close to an agreement whereby 50 women and children, Israeli civilians, would be released in return for 50 Palestinian women and children prisoners being freed. So if you could talk about the impact a ceasefire may have on the release of the Israeli civilian hostages in Gaza.
Right. So in Jewish tradition, we have a tradition that is called Pidyon Shvuim, which means that the release of the hostages comes first and at all costs. And that is to save lives. The bombing of Gaza, those hostages are in Gaza. When Gaza is being bombed, when we don't know where those hostages are, it puts them in danger too. There's going to be a day, there's come a judgment for Hamas and for those who have inflicted the horrible violence on Israel on October 7th. But right now, the focus has to be the release of those hostages. And the bombing that is clearly not very specifically targeted and is putting those hostages in harm's way is only exacerbating the situation and putting and not just myself, but including the Rhode Islanders who signed this letter. I've also joined hundreds of political scientists who signed a letter to demand immediate ceasefire for some of those same strategic reasons, humanitarian reasons, and also for the what is for me in the front of my mind, the release of the hostages. We buried today a peace activist who was murdered on October 7th, who had spent decades in activism trying to help to bring a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and continuing that tradition. There's Israelis who are continuing that tradition. There's Israelis in Israel now and abroad. There's organizations, both Palestinian and Jewish organizations, that are working towards that solution, to find a peaceful solution and to bring the hostages back. We have to have those negotiations, and if the negotiations have to happen with the group, with the terrorist group that is holding those hostages, there's no other way. There's no other solution for this. Get the hostages out. This is what the families of the hostages are demanding, and then we can continue the political work of rehabilitating Gaza, removing Hamas from power, and finding a political solution, which is really the only way that the roughly 7 million Jews and 7 million Palestinians who live between the river and the sea will ever be able to find peace.
Professor Ben-Akhti, we just have 30 seconds, but as the niece of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have the two senators from Rhode Island spoken to you, Jack Reed and Sheldon Whitehouse, or Seth Magaziner and Gabe Amo, the Congress members?
As Rhode Islanders, we speak to our delegation all the time. Our group that signed this letter and that sent them this letter spoke to our delegation. We're in contact all the time. We have various connections in our small state. And I think that we have a listening ear to all the different voices that are heard.
We have to leave it there. We thank you so much, Providence College political science professor Ruth Ben-Akhti, niece of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm Amy Goodman-Nirmi-Sheikh.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.